On September the 9th, Ken Starr sent his 445-page report to Congress, alleging 11 impeachable offenses. Even with all the crimes of Watergate, Leon Jaworski hadn't done that. The independent counsel was supposed to report his findings to Congress. Congress was supposed to decide whether there were grounds for impeachment. The report was made public on the 11th. Jaworski's never was made public. In Starr's report, the word sex appeared more than 500 times. Whitewater was mentioned twice. On September the 10th, I called the cabinet to the White House and apologized to them. Many of them didn't know what to say. They believed in what we were doing and appreciated the opportunity I had given them to serve, but most of them felt I'd been selfish and stupid and had left them hanging for 8 months. Madeleine Albright let off, saying that I had done wrong and she was disappointed, but our only option was to go back to work. Donna Shalala was tougher, saying it was important for leaders to be good people as well as to have good policies. My longtime friends James Lee Witt and Rodney Slater talked about the power of redemption and quoted scripture. Bruce Babbitt, a Catholic, talked about the power of confession. Carol Browner said she'd been forced to talk with her son about subjects she never thought she'd have to discuss with them. Listening to my cabinet, I really understood for the first time the extent to which the exposure of my misconduct and my dishonesty about it had opened a Pandora's box of emotions in the American people. It was easy enough to say that I had been through a lot in the past 6 years, and that Starr's inquisition had been awful, and the Jones lawsuit was bogus and politically motivated. Easy enough to say that even a president's personal life should remain private. But once what I had done was out there in all its stark ugliness, people's evaluations of it were inevitably a reflection of their own personal experiences, marked not only by their convictions, but also by their own fears, disappointments, and heartbreak. The atmosphere in the Yellow Oval Room remained awkward and tense until Bob Rubin spoke. Rubin had been through an exhaustive investigation of Goldman Sachs that featured one of his partners being hauled away in handcuffs before he was cleared. Bob was the one person in the room who best understood what my life had been like for the last 4 years. After several others had spoken, Rubin said with characteristic bluntness, "There's no question you screwed up, but we all make mistakes, even big ones. In my opinion, the bigger issue is the disproportion of the media coverage and the hypocrisy of some of your critics." The atmosphere got better after that. I'm grateful that no one quit. We all went back to work. Hillary and I began a serious counseling program, one day a week for about a year. For the first time in my life, I actually talked openly about feelings, experiences, and opinions about life, love, and the nature of relationships. I didn't like everything I learned about myself or my past, and it pained me to face the fact that my childhood and the life I'd led since growing up had made some things difficult for me that seemed to come more naturally to other people. I also came to understand that when I was exhausted and angry, I was more vulnerable to making selfish and self-destructive personal mistakes, about which I would later be ashamed. The current controversy was the latest casualty of my lifelong effort to lead parallel lives, to wall off my anger and grief and get on with my outer life, which I loved and lived well. During the government shutdown in November 1995, I was engaged in two titanic struggles, a public one with Congress over the future of our country, and a private one to hold the old demons at bay. I had won the public fight and lost the private one. There was no excuse for what I did, but trying to come to grips with why I did it at least gave me a chance to finally unify my parallel lives. In the long counseling sessions and our conversations about them afterward, Hillary and I also got to know each other again, beyond the work and ideas we shared and the child we adored. I had always loved her very much, but not always very well. I was grateful that she was brave enough to participate in the counseling. We were still each other's best friend, and I hoped we could save our marriage. Meanwhile, I was still sleeping on a couch, this one in the small living room that adjoined our bedroom. I slept on that old couch for 2 months or more. I got a lot of reading, thinking, and work done, and the couch was pretty comfortable, but I hoped I wouldn't be on it forever. On November 3rd, despite the huge Republican financial advantage, the attacks on me, and the pundits' predictions of the Democrats' demise, the elections went our way. Instead of the predicted loss of 4 to 6 Senate seats, there was no change. In the House of Representatives, the Democrats actually won back 5 seats, the first time the president's party had done so in the sixth year of a presidency since 1822. The election had presented a simple choice. The Democrats wanted to save Social Security first before spending our surplus on tax cuts or spending programs. Hire 100,000 teachers to give us smaller classes in the early grades. Modernize schools, raise the minimum wage, and pass the Patient's Bill of Rights. The Republicans were against all that. By and large, they ran a single-issue campaign on impeachment. Although in some states they also ran anti-gay ads, essentially saying that if the Democrats won Congress, we would force every state to recognize gay marriages. On the day after the election, I called Newt Gingrich to talk about some business. When the conversation got around to the election, he was very generous, saying that as a historian and, quote, the quarterback for the other team, he wanted to congratulate me. He hadn't believed we could do it, he said, and it was truly a historic achievement. Later in November, Erskine Bowles called to tell me about a very different conversation he had had with Gingrich. Newt told Erskine they were going to go forward with the impeachment despite the election results and the fact that many moderate Republicans didn't want to vote for it. When Erskine asked Newt why they would proceed with impeachment instead of other possible remedies, such as censure or the reprimand which Newt himself had received, the speaker replied, "Because we can." The right-wingers in the House caucus were seething over their defeat in the midterm election. Many actually believed they had lost because they had given in to too many White House demands in the last two budget negotiations. In fact, if they had run on the balanced budgets of 1997 and 1998, on the children's health insurance program and the 100,000 teachers, they would have done well, just as the Republican governors had. But they were too ideological and angry to do that. Now they were going to seize back control of the Republican agenda through impeachment. I had already had four showdowns with the radical right: the 1994 election, which they won, the budget showdown, the 96 election, and the 98 election, all of which went our way. In the interim, I had tried to work in good faith with Congress to keep the country moving forward. Now, in the face of overwhelming public opinion against impeachment, and the clear evidence that nothing I was alleged to have done rose to the level of an impeachable offense, they were coming back for another bitter ideological fight. There was nothing to do but suit up and take the field. Within a week after the election, two high-profile Washington politicians announced they wouldn't run again. Newt Gingrich stunned us all by announcing that he was resigning as Speaker and from the House. Apparently, he had a deeply divided caucus, was facing an assault on his leadership because of the election losses, and didn't want to fight anymore. Newt's announcement got more headlines, but the retirement of New York Senator Pat Moynihan would have a bigger impact on my family. On the night Moynihan said he wouldn't seek re-election, Hillary got a call from our friend Charlie Rangel, the congressman from Harlem and ranking member of the House Ways and Means Committee, to urge her to run for Moynihan's seat. Hillary told Charlie she was flattered, but couldn't imagine doing such a thing. She didn't completely close the door, and I was glad. It sounded like a pretty good idea to me. We had intended to move to New York after my term ended, with me spending a fair amount of time in Arkansas at my library. New Yorkers seemed to like having high-profile senators. Moynihan, Robert Kennedy, Jacob Javits, Robert Wagner, and many others had been seen as representatives of both the citizens of New York and the nation at large. I thought Hillary would do a great job in the Senate and that she would enjoy it, but that decision was months away. On the 8th, I brought my national security team to Camp David to discuss Iraq. A week earlier, Saddam Hussein had kicked the UN inspectors out of Iraq again, and it seemed almost certain that we'd have to take military action. The UN Security Council had voted unanimously to condemn Iraq's flagrant violations of UN resolutions. Bill Cohen had gone to the Middle East to line up support for airstrikes, and Tony Blair told me he was ready to participate. On November 19th, Ken Starr appeared before the House Judiciary Committee, making comments that, like his report, went far beyond the scope of his responsibility to report the facts he had found to Congress. The Starr report had already been criticized for omitting one big piece of evidence helpful to me: Monica Lewinsky's adamant assertion that I never asked her to lie. The most surprising thing to come out of Starr's testimony was his announcement that he had found no wrongdoing on my part or Hillary's in the travel office and FBI file investigations. Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts asked him when he had reached those conclusions. "Some months ago," Starr replied. Frank then asked him why he had waited until after the election to exonerate me on these charges, when he has submitted his report with a lot of negative stuff about the president before the election. Starr's brief response was confused and evasive.